Years at the Salt Lake Symposium. Marty also finished and defended her dissertation, received her PhD, and had her sixth child, and planned the Salt Lake Symposium. She is a woman of incredible accomplishments and a fantastic work ethic. She is thoroughly Mormon. Turn the time over to you.
I can hear Armin snickering back there about all the things I failed to get accomplished. No. Yeah, I'm really happy to share this night with both of you. I'm very happy for you. I'm sorry we were a little bit late. We thought this began at 8 o'clock. My heart's pounding. I've recently been reading a lot of work by a group of historians who use a concept called collective memory, and this is really an intriguing idea to me. I teach in the Graduate School of Architecture, and so I'm really interested in the way communities are built and the way the built environment is a reflection of what we care about. And collective memory really serves us well in that type of analysis. There are a group of historians who are writing about the impact of World War II on Europe, and how France and Germany and different places in Europe have selected certain parts of the memory of the war to keep as part of their official narrative and then discarded others. And this is a really interesting idea to me. Our collective memory is this unconscious choosing of what parts of the narration we will have via our official party line, the institutional history, and then what we'll discard. And there's this wonderful term for it in France, and it's literally discarded memory. And those of us who write women's history are really familiar with this phenomenon, because women's history has been for so long memory that plays out on the periphery of experience. These historians ask questions about how we choose what we'll remember, and then how do we choose what we'll forget. Our stories and our narration, our collective memory, serves us in social ways. It's partly about definition, but then it's also about boundaries. You know, who's inside, who's outside, who matters, who doesn't matter. And memory plays a very prominent role in that. It's all about inclusion, exclusion, and every generation has a different bias towards this memory. And arguably, our church has used memory in this way. And in fact, all institutions do. It's not surprising that this has happened. But those of us who study women's history, or those of us who are women in Mormon culture, I think, have grown up with a really incomplete narrative, you know, incomplete memories. And our ancestors, our female ancestors, have, as I said before, resided on the periphery of memory. I'm really interested in what goes on there, that transitional area, or that edge of history, that edge of memory, is always more interesting to me than what's going on in the mainstream. This history is unabashedly history on the edge. You know, it's women's history. It's taken from a point of view that is distinctly female. In fact, one of the greatest compliments I've gotten about this book, and I think this was said sort of offhandedly, Ron Pritis at Signature Books called me up and he said, "Well, Marty, this is just so funny to me the way he said this. He said, this is women's history." And I said, "Well, yeah." He said, "No, really. I had never really thought about how different your point of view is from mine." You know, he said, "Your story's different. You're interested in different things in the story." And to me, that was the best thing he could have said to me, because it was so much what I had hoped to accomplish. So in the Four Sinas, women are brought into the center, into the spotlight, from the edge, from the periphery, and at least in this particular study, given that kind of treatment. I think by acquiring this type of new historical memory, we can empower women. You know, maybe my four daughters will be the only ones who are empowered by this book, but I think that really matters. And so their collective memories will include a greater sense of what their ancestry is, what the female ancestry of women in the church is. It's based on the assumption that women's experience in the world of Mormonism was fundamentally different from that of men. Women's perception and conceptualization of their lives and their theology was different. They experienced religion in every way differently and engaged in religious activities in gendered manners. There are a few themes or bodies of ideas that inform this space. Thank you. And I start, maybe I'd like to talk to you a little bit about those before I start describing their lives, because that's when this gets way out of control and really complicated. Can't go back and forth. The first one is the idea of gender. And for those of you who don't really know what the term gender means, you kind of have a fuzzy idea of it. Gender is a little bit different from when we talk about sex, male versus female. Gender is about the roles we play in society. And it was very interesting in doing this four-generational study to see the way gender roles changed or evolved over time. And they changed dramatically. The life of a woman in America, in Utah, in 1967 was very different from that 100 years earlier, or even 150 years earlier than that. And this is the time period that these women's lives describe. Gender is probably the most central issue in this narrative. And we find these women, these four Zinas, and their daughters raising families, each of them. We see them manufacturing cloth and producing goods for their families. We see them holding meetings and presiding over meetings. We see them testifying in interviews and in church. We see them maintaining their gardens and producing food products for their families. We see them teaching school. We see them nursing ill or midwifing. They had limited formal authority, but their activities took on a heightened meaning in the private arena, and I'll explain what I mean by that in a few minutes. As was true of most women in the post-Revolutionary War time period, women had enormous influence within the confines of their homes. There, they were the principal transmitter of values to their children, and this was a very important responsibility that they held. They were the leaders in the socialization of their children. They had to teach their children what it meant to be a member of a town and a church, how to interact with members of their families and their neighbors. Mothers were their daughters' primary mediators with the environments around them. In the Mormon community, as was true of most of America during this time period, there were rigid gender differentiations that were in the Mormon environment dictated largely by theology. For men and women, gender roles meant the adoption of social rules or conventions of masculine and feminine behavior. This was prescribed through time and through space. Their culture defined largely what they could do, and those conventions shaped their life. This understanding about gender was lovingly transferred from mother to daughter and handed down, you know, as if it was a gift. Zina Baker taught Zina Diantha what it meant to be a woman in upstate New York. Zina Diantha helped her daughter Zina Crescendia know what it meant to be a polygamous wife. Zina Crescendia taught her daughter Zina Young to speak eloquently, to stand straight up and tall. They learned together the role they would play in the Mormon world. And perhaps the most important contribution of our book, I think, is this generational approach. The second issue after gender is this mother-daughter relationship. Although most of us, I think, take the mother-daughter relationship for granted, it was immensely important in the lives of these women that we study. Much of their lives was spent in negotiating these relationships. There's a famous historian, woman named Gerda Lerner, in her book, The Creation of Feminist Consciousness, says this about the importance of the role of women as mothers. She says, as mothers, their duty to instruct the young provided them with the authority to express their ideas on a broad range of subjects. Armed with such authority, they could give advice, instruction on morals, and offer theological interpretations. In the modern period, women would reason their way to claims of equality based on motherhood, and later even to group consciousness. As mothers, then, these women had power. They had influence, they had authority, and they passed on that sense of power through stories to their daughters. The third issue is the role that women played in Christianity. Indisputably, during this time period, religion played a central role in the lives of women. In fact, these churches promised women a measure of authority. These were public places where women could speak and prophesy and exercise spiritual gifts. This was never questioned. You know, women were welcomed players in religious dramas. Religion changed the way they viewed themselves and the way they viewed the world, and it brought them out of the domestic sphere and included them in a public arena. Religion freed them from traditional ways of being, and it resulted in an emotional rebirth through the Second Great Awakening that became a sort of rite of passage. And it was spoken of by each of these women in a very routinized way, sort of interesting thing to see, and was manifested in also stylized sort of routinized way. I thought I'd just tell you a little bit about the background of the book. It's co-authored by myself and a woman named Mary Brown Firmage Woodward. And she was the daughter of the last Zina that we studied. The last Zina was her mother. So Zina grew up in a household where there were photographs of these women on the mantle of her fireplace and in her mother's bedroom. When Zina's mother was in her 50s, she started dividing up some of the things that they had, you know, between the different daughters. There were 8 children in the family, and they all had dibs on different things that they wanted. And Zina and Mary sat down on the rug in their living room one day, and they were looking at a little red tin bread box that Zina Clark Brown had gotten from her mother. And it was filled with letters and diaries and clippings and other precious documents. And this is what she was giving to Mary. And very precious stuff. There were letters from Joseph Smith, letters from William Huntington, Hiram Smith, William Clayton. It was just sort of irresistible, wonderful primary source material. Mary had sort of become the designated historian in the family, and so she had boxes and boxes of things that people gave her because they didn't want to save them in their own homes. And one of the boxes included papers that had been found in the walls of the log cabin of the Charles Card and Zina Card home in Cardston, Canada. When Zina Card lived there, it was a log cabin, and she wanted it to be beautiful, so she tacked up flannel on the log walls. And in that space between the flannel and the walls, they had stuffed their private papers. And so when they were restoring the building and they tore down the flannel, all this wonderful stuff was put out. So those materials were part of this collection as well. A granddaughter of Mary's, a woman named Zina Elizabeth Brown, inherited a trunk when her grandfather, Hubie Brown, died. And she kept it as a coffee table in the middle of her living room for years and years and years before she ever opened it. And when she opened it, inside of it was her grandmother, her great-grandmother, Zina Diantha Young's wedding dress, and little bundles of letters and 2 little journals. And these journals they're just precious. They're this big. And one describes Zina Diantha's life in Nauvoo, and the other one describes her life when she first arrived in Utah and lived in the old fort for the next 2 years. So they're just really precious, incredibly precious documents. Well, in 1992, Mary invited me over to lunch one day. It was when I was teaching at BYU, and she set this really beautiful luncheon. You know, she's really a proper lady. And on the table in front of me were these papers, and they were fanned out in these sort of decorative arrangements, you know. I'm like, okay, my curiosity has addressed me. I waited until the speech was done, and then I asked her what was going on. And she said, Martha, dear, and she's so sweet. She's just such a dear. She said, would you just do me the biggest favor? Would you help me write the story of my grandmother? You know, and then she told me about these letters, and these letters were a collection of 36 letters that were written by her, by the first Zina that we studied, Zina Baker, to her mother, Zina Baker Huntington, to her mother, Dorcas Baker, in Plainfield, New Hampshire, and they go from 1806 to 1835. And just a sort of unparalleled collection of letters between the mother and daughter from that time period. So that's kind of how the project began, and 8 years later, here we are. So let me tell you a little bit about the 4 Zinas, and then at the end, I'm sure you'll have all kinds of questions, and I can send those to Todd or Michael, and they can answer them for you. Good strategy? Okay. Okay, the first Zina is, and this would be so much better with a chalkboard because this is so incredibly complicated, but I'll hopefully help you to understand who I'm talking about. Zina Baker Huntington was 19 years old when she and her husband, William, left New Hampshire to go to Watertown, New York, where William's father and mother and some of his brothers had started a new town. It was Watertown. It was a frontier town in upstate New York. During the next 30 years, she writes letters back home. And this is this body of letters that was, you know, spread out on the table. We learn about Zina, this first Zina Baker, from those letters. That's the only source, only principal primary source material we have that tell us about what she was thinking, what was going on in her life during that time period. And they're just precious. In those letters, she's always bemoaning the fact that she can't see her mother. You know, she's like, that's always how it begins. She's just really sad that she can't see her mother. But it describes everything she does. From those letters, we get a sense of what her daily work was. You know, what were the sorts of things that were required of a woman in the early 19th century. You know, she gathered flax out of the field. She turned that flax eventually into cloth. She produced all the cloth for the family's clothes. She had a vegetable garden. You know, she put up the food for the family. She had a domestic, a female sphere of responsibility, vital to the family's survival. You know, it was real, it was tangible. She was a part of the economic circle that supported her family. She was a devoted mother and daughter and wife and friend. Her principal interests were her faith, her family, and her work. She was good humored. She had a great sense of humor. One of my very favorite letters is one where she says, dear, her mother's name is Dorcas. She says, my dear mother, I've grown almost as large as you. And then she says, to prove it, she's going to send a string. She's measured around the waist how fast she's got. And so she stuffs the string in the letter and sends it to her. You know, she's really good humored about it, though. She gets heavy and then she gets less heavy, and, you know, and she has all these children, and she has a sense of humor about it. She's hardworking. She faces each of the challenges that they have on the family farm with good humor, with enthusiasm, and always very supportive to her husband, William. She finds much to be grateful for. She had 10 children with her husband in Watertown and lost 3 of them before they were 10 years old. She also felt the heavy responsibility of teaching her daughters what it meant to be a woman. You know, she taught Zina, Diantha, and Cassandra, and her other daughters this round of female responsibility, round of female work. She was a frontier community builder in the truest sense, and her role was as vital and as important as her husband's role. She had a significant interest throughout her the last 10 years that she was in Watertown in religion. This was the period of the Second Great Awakening, and it's like a textbook example of it. I mean, these letters are just too good to be true, because the revivals come through, and she talks about the energy of the preachers, and she's got good descriptions of some of them, and, you know, some others are flat, and she's uninterested in them. But it's just like this weather report. You know, you always get the relative read on religious enthusiasm in the area. In one place, I love this phrase, she says, this is a place stupid in matters of religion. And that was her way of saying, people aren't getting this, you know, and they're not really getting into it. And she also talks about the great religious diversity that comes through the area, you know, and their universalism, Presbyterians and Methodists, and all kinds of other variations. And she tries a little bit of all of it. In 1835, they first meet up with the Mormon missionaries, and they meet with Abram Smith and John Smith and Joseph Smith Sr., David Whitmer, and stays at their home as well. And it's not clear if John Smith or Joseph Smith Sr. baptized Zina and William, but they are baptized in 1835, and a few months later, Zina, Diantha, and the younger children are baptized as well. After they were baptized, they wanted to leave Watertown to go to join with the saints. At that time, they had been in Watertown and had been working their farm for 30 years. You know, when they were at a point in their life where most people just want to ride it out, you know. You've got your family's farm, you've got your children pretty much raised, and you're comfortable, you're successful. And instead, they sell their farm at a huge loss and pack up everything they think they need, and they hit the road. They travel in a steamboat and in a canal boat, and they walk a distance to Kirtland, where they join with a body of saints who are there. Now, in the meantime, Zina Diantha is an adolescent. Okay, Zina Diantha is 14 when she's baptized, but by the age of 13, Zina Diantha was already speaking in tongues. And when Zina Diantha spoke in tongues in her family home, her mother, Zina Baker, never questioned it. You know, in fact, she wrote home to her mother saying, "Cassandra and Zina have something special. in terms of their spiritual nature. And this is something that she supports them in. You know, she doesn't say that foolish, she doesn't say that stupid or weird, you know, but she supports them in that. And throughout both of their lives, they're always well known as having this special spiritual nature. Dhyanadeyanta was described by many people as being one of the most remarkable special people that they had ever met. Oliver described her as the most unselfish person that he had ever known. They made a substantial contribution throughout their lives, and Dhyanadeyanta in particular, to the spiritual life of Mormon women. And Dhyanadeyanta, even though this book is about four women, she's pretty much the centerpiece. She's by far the most interesting character in it. Dhyana believes more than anything else. Her central focus in her sense of faith was in the prophetic leadership of Joseph Smith, and that's really important. She was asked to do a lot of things that sort of went against her sense of morality, against the grain, and it was always, you know, that was the principle it always came back to. If she believed Joseph Smith was a prophet of God, and that, you know, was the way she made decisions about things. I think it obligated her to do whatever he said, you know, regardless of how far out it might have seemed to some of us with our 20th century sensibilities. To her, she really believed that Joseph was speaking for God. Eventually, that would include the test for her of plural marriage. Dhyanadeyanta traveled with her family from Kirtland to Missouri. In Missouri, their family's right in the heart of the action, you know. Her brother Dimmock is a Danite. Her father William is in charge of the exodus or the movement outside of Missouri to Nauvoo. So, you know, they're key players, and they're making friends that will stay with them all the way to Utah. And I think perhaps even more importantly, she's starting to be noticed by Joseph and some of the other leaders of the church. When they arrive in Quincy and eventually in Nauvoo, most of the members of the family contract malaria, and her mother, Zina Baker, gets so sick that she dies. And when her mother dies, Zina and some of her brothers are so sick they can't even go to the burial. But not long after that, Zina becomes well enough to go work in the Smith home to nurse the sick. There are a whole bunch of people who are sick. They're just lying in rows on the floor of the Smith's home, and Zina and a number of other young women who eventually will become plural wives of Joseph Smith go and tend to the sick in the Smith's home. In Nauvoo, she was courted in 1840 by a young man named Henry Bailey Jacobs. And Henry was described as a nice-looking young man with dark curly hair who could play a violin, and he was good friends with some of her younger brothers. And he courted her hot and heavy when he was in town. Sometimes he would be gone on missions, and they married in the spring of 1841. Certainly sometime before that, her brother Dimmock had told her that Joseph was had the impression that she should become his plural wife. Zina knew that when she married Henry, but sort of believed by marrying Henry that maybe, you know, that would put Joseph off, and she could maybe avoid it in that way. But a few months later, Dimmock came to her again and told her that Joseph believed that she should become his spiritual wife. And this is what she wrote in an autobiography later on. She said, "Joseph said, 'Tell Zina I have put it off and put it off until an angel with a drawn sword has stood before me and told me if I did not establish that principle, meaning plurality, and live it, I would lose my position and my life and the church would progress no further.'" Dimmock was sealed Zina to Joseph on the 27th of October, 1841, on the banks of the Mississippi River, and Zina was pregnant with her son Zebulon with Henry. While she was in Nauvoo, Henry frequently was sent on missions, and so a lot of the time she was there by herself. And when Henry was on a mission, she had to take care of herself, you know, she had to support herself. And one of the things she would do to earn money to support herself and her little boy was to hold little schools, and she called her students little scholars. And this just cracked me up, because Zina was the worst speller. She was the worst speller. She could not spell Fastendia's name. One of the big headaches of writing this book was figuring out how the heck we did spell Fastendia, because every time Zina and everyone else spelled it, it was different. But she was teaching children how to spell. She also was one of the first members of the Nauvoo Relief Society, and in the Relief Society she developed a number of important friendships. I think perhaps more importantly, she developed loyalty and learned to speak. After Joseph's death, and in her journal, she refers to Joseph Smith as the Sanctified, as a code name for him. And in the wake of his death, Brigham Young and some of the other leaders of the church made a decision to divide up Joseph's spiritual wives and to be sealed in a temple sense to some of them. And Zina was one of the women that Brigham married in this way, and her sister Crescendia was sealed to Heber C. Kimball. Brigham, before he married her, divorced her from Henry, and then was sealed to Zina in the Nauvoo Temple with Henry as a witness. When she was sealed to him, this is the part I'm just tripping in around, right? When she was sealed to him, plural marriage, you know, the idea of moving into a polygamous family was new to Zina. I can't even imagine what it must have, what they must have thought when they were first introduced to that idea, because these women were raised in monogamous families. You know, they had the same Victorian background as most other Americans. So it was new to them. But again, she believed Joseph was a prophet of God, and so she found a way to accept those things that she'd been told to do. The rules about how to do it hadn't been articulated yet. And, you know, part of the messy way that those things were done during this very troubling couple of years, I think, was because there were no clear-cut guidelines about what was right, what was the proper way of doing it. When they left Nauvoo, Henry took Zina and their son Zebulon to Mount Pisgah, and on their way there, on the banks of the Cherokee River, Zina delivered her second son, and they named the son Cherokee, you know, the name of the river. A number of women, a number of people were really moved by this event, because it was snowing, and it was really, really cold, the river was frozen. And there are several different accounts of this poor woman lying in snow on the top of this wagon covered with, you know, bales of clothing and things. And everyone was just really impressed by her strength and her courage and the way she handled herself in that. Once they got to Mount Pisgah, Henry was called on another mission, this time to England. And so she was there for a period of time with her father William, and that's where her father William died. Next, she went to winter quarters, and her time in winter quarters was really important because that's the first time she was a member, in a literal sense, of the plural family of Brigham Young. And that's a really interesting time. the men are gone for most of that time, and so there are groups of women who are just killing time, you know, and they have a lot of testimony meetings, a lot of blessing meetings, a lot of prayer meetings. And they established really strong friendships, and their friendships are based on spirituality, you know, this common spiritual activity. Eliza Arsenault and Zina really forged a very important friendship in winter quarters. I think that's a really important time because it's like a bonding trip, you know, and they get rock solid relationships that they carry throughout their lives after that. Zina comes to Utah in 1848, and when first lives in Utah, she lives in the old fort down in Pioneer Park in the middle of downtown Salt Lake. She lives in a really small little room, about 10 feet by 10 feet, with her two little sons. It's, you know, not very desirable place to live. It's so drafty, holes in the ceiling when it snows. Her sister Crescendia talks about putting up an umbrella so when it snowed, she and her children could lie underneath it, and the snow would go to the sides of them. I mean, it's just really pathetic. But in the journal, and this is one of the journals that we have intact, Zina doesn't complain about that. She's just so jazzed about these meetings they have at night. And almost every single night, they go to someone else's room, and they hold a prayer meeting, a fast meeting, they have dancers, they have all these things going on. It's just an incredibly social, spiritual time. And to Zina, it's a very meaningful, exciting period of time. She's not talking about a privation. She's really talking about that great feeling of community that's being built in that way. Eventually, she moves to the Log Row with some of the other plural wives and to the Lion House for a period of time and then into a home on her own. In Utah, Zina Zayanta becomes an important leader of women. When Eliza Arsenault helps to reorganize the relief societies in the late 1860s, Zina goes with her, and they travel in buggies and in different methods of transportation throughout the territory, and they're very popular many times in the newspaper and eventually in the Women's Exponent, their visits will be noted with great enthusiasm. And this is so interesting to read. Usually they would have Eliza talk, and Eliza would give this great spiritual method, talking a little bit about theology, sometimes about Mother in Heaven. And then I sort of imagine, and this is just my imagination, that they go, Zina, 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 you know, and then Zina goes up and she speaks in tongues. I mean, they loved for her to do that. And she does it in Kanab, and she does it in Tooele, and Brigham City, and everywhere they go. And, you know, she'll bear testimony. But eventually they get to the point where, by acclamation, she's asked to speak in tongues, and then someone comes and translates. Or sometimes she would speak in the inspirational, she would do inspirational singing as well. But that was what she became known for throughout the church, by the women of the church. Eventually, after the death of Eliza R. Snow, what became president of the general president of the Relief Society herself. She led out in the sericulture movement, which is the silk raising movement. She was the person who was really the lead out figure on that. She also was an important player in the movement for women's rights and the suffrage movement, as was her daughter, Jennifer Kenia, who I'll talk about next. She was well known as a midwife and as an advocate for improved methods of ensuring female health. Zina, Diantha lived for most of her life without a husband in her house, and I think that's a pretty significant thing, even though her whole life was pretty much designed to address the form of marriage. You know, it was the shape of her life was formed in line with the prescriptions of this form of marriage. She was pretty much on her own most of her life. In 1850, she had a daughter with Brigham Young. She would have one child with Brigham Young, and her daughter's name was Zina Prescendia. Zina Prescendia was raised in a polygamous household and was in Utah. A member of a very elite, very privileged family. You know, she was the closest thing you had to a princess in Utah Territory. She was one of 10 daughters that Brigham Young had in an 18-month time period, and they were called the Big Ten. And they were hot stuff. I mean, they were courted by all the great, you know, young men in town, and she was courted by T.D.H. Stenhouse. Some of you may be familiar with that name. But she chose an older man. She chose to be the second wife of a man in his 40s. His name was Thomas Williams. Thomas Williams worked at the Salt Lake Theater. Zina Prescendia really liked acting and was frequently in plays at the Salt Lake Theater. And she and some of the other Big Ten took fairy dancing, which was essentially ballet dancing. She was married to Thomas Williams for less than 10 years. She had two children with him when he had a heart attack and died. And so at a very young age, you know, in her mid-20s, she was a widow. You know, and in frontier Utah, just about the worst thing to be is single if you're a woman. And a young widow, even if you were the daughter of Brigham Young, it was difficult. And what her father encouraged her to do was to advantage of the Homestead Act of 1862 and homestead some land down in Sevier County, which she did. Her Uncle Jimmick built her a log cabin on the land down in Sevier County. Have any of you ever been to Sevier County? She didn't like it much. And, and the letters that she wrote home to her mother, Zina Diantha, were, get me out of here, you know, I can't stand this for 5 years, and all I can hear at night are wolves, and, Isn't it Richfield, and, yeah, Richfield, it's in the center, it's desolate, and, anyway, she was too social. I mean, first of all, she grew up in this house with all these fun sisters and brothers, and, you know, she was always in the middle of social activities, and now she's out in the middle of nowhere. You know, and she talks about, in her letters, she talks about critters in the roof, and, you know, she's scared to death, so she's always on trips visiting her cousins and her sisters, and so, but she does, by, at the end of the 5 years, she can claim the land. But by that time, Carl Major was organizing BY Academy, and Carl Major was the teacher for the Brigham Young Family School in Salt Lake City, where he had taught Rana Sashendia, and he thought she was really special. He knew that she needed to earn a living for herself, and so he asked her if she would move to Provo and become the first matron of the BY Academy, and she did that, and she was very successful at it. In fact, throughout her life, she would have a series of positions as the matron of the BY Academy, BY College, and then the LDS Business College. So she was an important female educator. The curriculum that she prescribed is pretty fun. You know, women in the late 1870s and 80s, they would go to a female seminary where they would learn how to set a really great-looking table, you know? And so it's not liberal education. They weren't reading Shakespeare. So her curriculum was about home economics, which was pretty much run-of-the-mill stuff. It was, but then another thing that she also did was a class that they called gymnasium. And I think it really reflects the influence of her father, who was really into physical culture. And they would wear big bloomers, and they would carry Indian clubs and do exercises. And so that was her contribution to BY Academy. While she was there, the women's building caught on fire, and one of the fathers of some of the students was down there, and he helped pull furniture out of the building, and he impressed her so much that they started to correspond. His name was Charles O'Card. And Charles O'Card was a lot older than her, and he already had plural families, and he lived in Logan. He's a very prominent figure up there. During that time period, she was corresponding with Charles O'Card. She also was, I don't know what the words would be for it, not dating, but J. Golden Kimball and her had a thing going. And when he went on his mission, he corresponded with her for the first several months. But eventually, she came to the point where she accepted a proposal for marriage with Charles O'Card. They became married during the time period known in Utah as the Underground, and which means that she couldn't invite people to her wedding, and she couldn't go home with him that night. And so their first weeks they're fun, reading the letters. You know, it's the subterranean, sneaking around and wearing costumes. But it's not a great way to start a marriage. And so it's just a kind of broken heart that she's pointing out in some of those letters. John Taylor invites Charles Card down to Salt Lake to talk about the idea of starting a colony for the polygamists outside of Utah. And before Charles goes there, he hears that John Taylor is thinking about doing a colony in Mexico, and he thinks that's going to be great. You know, that sounds really fun. But when he gets down there, John Taylor suggests to him that maybe he would be better suited to start a colony in Canada. And initially, he's not really jazzed about the idea, but he eventually gets to the point where he accepts it. And so that's why we have cards from Canada. That's Charles O'Card and Zina Crescendia Williams Card, his wife. They're really the two founding pioneers of the Cardston area. Now, let's see. So I don't get confused here. Okay, so like her mother and like her grandmother, she was a community builder. She lived on the frontier. She was required to make enormous shifts in what she expected out of life to make the best of what she had been given. Interestingly enough, Zina Crescendia also lived the majority of her life without a husband in her home. Charles lived with her in Canada for less than 10 years and moved back to Logan and died. She didn't have a husband for most of the time that she reared her children. But she did have a beautiful golden-haired daughter while she was up in Cardston, Canada, and that's Zina Young, which makes this really confusing, Zina Young Card. And Zina Young Card eventually becomes Zina Young Card Brown. Zina Young Card was the daughter of the two premier peers in the Mormon Canadian colonies. She was the adored golden-haired daughter who it was determined was very talented. Zina Crescendia, as I said before, really loved acting. And when she was up in the Canadian colonies, she always had theater groups going. And she was always the leader of the young women's organizations, and they would do plays and Shakespeare and all these great dramas. And so Zina Young Card had been raised in that theatrical environment. And so by the time she was 13, 14, she wanted to be an elocutionist. And she was quite certain that she would be a professional woman, with a career. Well, one time when she was down in, their family came down to Logan, as they frequently would, to visit their, the other families of the Card family. She was giving a presentation to a group of students at the BY College, which is, you know, the Logan branch, and in the audience was Hugh B. Brown. And she was a few years older than Zynex Young Card, and he leaned over to Zynex Ascendia, and he said to her, "Someday I will marry your daughter." And Zynex Ascendia, after that meeting, apparently sent Zynex straight back up to Canada and really discouraged him, saying, "No, you won't. She's way too young, and she's going to be in college, and, you know, she's going to be a professional, and she's really special." But he was just, you know, relentless in her pursuit, and over the next several years, struck up a good relationship with Zynex Ascendia, a really smart strategy. Get friends with some prospective mother-in-law, and then you've got a shoe-in. Zynex Young Card is a really interesting figure, very different from the other three women. She, if you think about it, Zynex Diantha and Zynex Ascendia, they step into a very public arena. You know, they speak at women's conventions in the national suffrage movement. They're very public figures. Zynex Young Card steps back. She steps out of the public arena back into the domestic sphere. It's really an interesting shift to me. The 20th century figure here is far more domestic in her orientation than those late 19th century women. She chooses, and I think it's from a position of strength, to play a secondary role in her marriage. The marriage between Hugh B. Brown and Zynex Young Card Brown is a romantic love match, you know, from the word go. They have the mustiest relationship. It's so wonderful. And volumes of letters from their early courtship when she is an adolescent to the time of her death. And never changes. You know, just this passion and energy for each other. It's just so lovely. Zynex always believed that Hugh wasn't as self-confident as he might be. And she knew she was great, you know. So she, well, no, this is so cool to me because it's from a position of power. It's not a position of weakness. She chooses to step back and let him shine. And she does everything throughout her life to make sure that that happens, to compliment him, you know, and to do what he needs her to do, to make sure he can do all of the different things that the church asks him to do. I thought I would, in conclusion, just read a few pages from the very end of my book, and then I'll open up for questions. Where are the traces of the Zynex in Zynex Brown's story? In what ways did her life follow a pattern drawn before her birth, and in what ways did she redefine her life to make it her own? Like her mother and grandmother, Zynex Brown's life was supported by gender. Hers was a traditional Mormon family, and in some ways she was the quintessential 1950s housewife. But if asked to define her life, she would have said she did not want a life made easy because of modern conveniences, but rather one that was good. She did not receive many accolades. She was known primarily throughout the church as the wife of a distinguished man. But how much did that cost her? Her life ended with a husband who adored her, children who spoke fondly and respectfully of her memory. Hers was the story of a marriage in the truest sense. Undoubtedly, she would have said it cost her nothing to have such a life, but rather she had been richly blessed. Four generations of women, each unique but each engaged in a dance through space, with sheets of silk billowing in the air behind them. What dreams sustained Zynex Baker during her move to upstate New York? What convinced Zynex Diantha to enter plural marriage? What did Zynex Card give thanks for and celebrate? In Zynex Brown's dream of romantic love fulfilled, what lessons does her life teach of sacrifice, selflessness, and support? What questions does each woman's life pose? The knots, the paradoxes, the parts they would have diminished or explained away. Zynex Baker's unfortunate slide down the economic ladder until her death. Zynex Diantha's sacrifice of a good man in a loving and stable marriage. Zynex Card's practical first marriage and sacrificial second. Zynex Brown's marriage for love and the resulting abandonment of education and a career. As writers, we know that a certain level of engagement with our subjects is inevitable. But here, our subjects were also our muses. Perhaps it is impossible to satisfy all our queries, but even as these questions linger, we feel their answers. Reflections of four portraits. It matters that they live. for these were four women of strength and courage who persevered on the frontiers of their time. They built communities and homes and had babies and buried loved ones, gave speeches and spoke in tongues, were recognized by leaders of countries and by the children at their feet. The cycle began with Zina Baker in Watertown and moved through her daughter to her granddaughter, Zina Brown. Faith, family, work, and mutual support spun the fiber of their lives. Their legacy may ultimately be indecipherable, but the effort is rewarding. Many modern women, Mormon or not, are engaged in the struggle to redefine themselves. In this, they must reconcile traditional historical definitions of women with modern scripts our culture says are worth living for. Sometimes the pull seems to be between two incompatible poles. Yet while these definitions appear to be mutually exclusive, modern women must somehow integrate them into their lives. Most often they are defined and fails to recognize the rich diversity of experience that formed the past. Women and men contributed differently. If Zina Diantha were to recount to her daughter stories of what it meant to be female in 19th century Utah, she would tell about cooking and childbearing, menstruation and pregnancy, of God and heroes, angels and devils. She would tell stories about the land and the sky, of the trail west, of Illinois and Missouri, stories of snakes and spiders, horses and cows. Zina would tell her about dressing and undressing, about herself, her mother, and her sister, about grieving and laughing, about healing with herbs and faith, stories about who she was, where she came from, who she was supposed to be. Through the words she used and the images she spun, she would capture what life was and was not. Most of what she told would not be of traditional history of great men. Women like the four Zinas lived both ordinary and extraordinary lives, defined in large measure by the routine familiar to all women of their time, the fulfillment of dream and mission and satisfaction together. Each might have hoped for more or better, perhaps for less pain or difficulty, but they made the most of what they had. It would be tempting to make heroes of these women, and one catches oneself using too many superlatives. The most generous, the most spiritual, the most kind. They made the people around them feel better. They worked with them, cared for them, tended to their every need. They did this because that is who they were. They defined themselves by what they did, and they handed that heritage from mother to daughter with each generation. As historians, we hope our readers will love the read. The narrative of the lives of these women is rich and entertaining, but there is also much to learn here. We can never make the journeys these women made. Traveling in the back of a bouncing wagon across to Missouri, riding the train to Canada, or moving through a series of miscarriages or homes, for it seems that such great journeys or challenges no longer exist, but the journey still informs each day we live. The lines that run from mother to daughter are not as tangible as rope, but are nonetheless gracefully strung through women as strands of gold. It matters that Zina was their mother, Zina Presendia, their grandmother, and that Zina Diantha and Zina Baker are in them too. Their stories are our stories, yet unfinished. So thank you. So do you have any questions? Yes.
Somewhere, and she had the second baby.
Yeah, that was Henry's second son, and his name is Cheriton.
So after she still lives with him, even once he's divorced from him?
Well, yeah, technically that's true. We don't know what they did when they lived together, but they were together. Henry continued to be responsible for her until she got to winter. Henry took care of her until Mount Pisgah.
Was she already pregnant when she was killed to bring up?
Right.
Oh, she was already pregnant
with
her second son.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And
what became of him?
Of Henry. Okay. Henry went on a mission to England with Oliver. And the letters Henry wrote Zina in the next few years are heartbreaking. Right, exactly, yeah. Henry's a great guy in my mind. I mean, he's willing to do this because he also believes Brigham Young is a prophet. And it's very difficult for him to do it. He's not just losing Zida, he's losing his children. And so he goes, but when he goes on this mission, he meets someone that he marries, and he has a few wives. He is eventually, don't laugh at it. I mean, it's part of the game during that time period. And he moves to California for a period of time and is disfellowshipped. And, it's speculated, and there's not any hard data, that maybe he's disfellowshipped because he kept writing to Zina. And, but this is interesting. This is an interesting thing. I was with one of my friends. I really like cemeteries. Some of you probably do. So I was up at the Salt Lake Cemetery, and we were looking for everybody that were interested in graves, and we couldn't find Zina anywhere. And eventually find her. Guess who she's buried next to? She's married next to Henry. She's buried in Jacob's plot. When Henry was dying, he wrote to his sons and said, I've got this terminal disease, and they invited him to come to Utah, and he lived for a few months in Zina's home. So the last few months before he died, he's in her house. It's the 1880s. It's after the Edmunds Act, Edmunds Tucker Act, when the federal marshals are pursuing the polygamists, and most of the polygamists go into hiding that are prominent. A long time ago, I wrote the history of ZCMI, and it was really interesting because in those years, the heads of the board of directors had no one in attendance. They would have like the scribe. None of the principal players in ZCMI were around for the meetings because they were on the underground. And that's just one indication of it, and they would come and they would go. And it's a great time period to study. You should read about it.
That's before the manifesto.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The decade before. Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Funny evidence of Zina's heart, his vision, and the intellectual life that we've done.
Zina Young card? It's a good question.
Did she find any evidence of Zina Carr's participation in the intellectual life of Dugan?
Yeah, okay. His question is, did I find any evidence of Zina Young Card's involvement in the intellectual life of Hubie Brown? And I didn't. I think she was perhaps his muse. When he wrote about marriage, he was certainly writing about his experience with Zina, but she wasn't his intellectual playmate or partner in any sense, I don't think. Which isn't to say she wasn't smart. She just wasn't interested in theology in the same way that he was. Because she was a bright woman. She was a poet. She wrote beautiful poetry and she could spell. More importantly, Yes. Mm-hmm.
Did Brigham Young express why he felt that he should marry Zina?
Brigham Young didn't write down anywhere a good explanation for why he felt like he should marry Zina, and there's a lot of speculation about it. The best source on that is Todd's book, In Sacred Loneliness, I think. Todd does a really good job of explaining. I think that Brigham and Heber C. Kimball and some of the other leaders really believed it was their responsibility to care for these people that Joseph had identified as being special, having a particular destiny that was linked to his. And so the responsibility they take on is on this earth, a temporal responsibility. It's not a spiritual marriage in the same sense that it was to Joseph. I think it's a very difficult question.
Yeah, well, because she had this other husband who could take care of her physically on this earth. So
right, yeah.
It's strange.
Yep, what would you say to that, Todd?
I just mentioned it. I didn't explain it. I tried to explain it.
There you go. And I reference you. Better strategy.
Honey, we have so many clues, and yet at the end of putting all the clues together, we don't have a complete understanding of what we're doing.
Yeah. You'll have other people say.
More houses, more dust.
Yeah, there you go. There's probably more. You hear other people say, I bet Zina did it because she thought she would get to a higher kingdom or a higher degree of glory, but you never see Zina saying that. So.
How much attention did the Zinas, or the ones who kept journals, pay to the, how much page space do they get describing their husbands and sons versus their daughters, say, and mothers?
I know what you're I know the kind of question you're asking. Could you do like a content analysis of gender preference or something like that? Then
whatever it means.
No, you know. Well, first of all, the principal journal keeper in this story is Zina Diantha. Zina Diantha is with a husband for a few years in Nauvoo and on and off for about a decade after she gets to, 20-some years in Utah. And once in a while she'll mention that she got invited by Brigham to a dance, something like that, but she doesn't hardly ever go much further than that. You can kind of tell, I think you can tell the night that they cohabit for the first time. It's a little different, her reference to him, but there's hardly any other description of what she thinks of him as a church leader, not as a husband, you know, not personal insights into how she might have felt about him as a husband. Wish there was some, you know, you want to know that kind of thing, but there's not. And that was a great deal for Zina. Zina got to live in public as his wife, you know, and so it was only for a few years, but it was something that was different for her in that family, because the other plural wives never could do that, and so that was important. She was older than two of the other plural wives, more mature. She had had more experience in frontier life. Her time in Sevier County prepared her for her time in Canada. And, you know, she was also a powerhouse. You know, she was a leader. She had been bred to be a leader, and so she, you know, she was the perfect person for it. And they decided as a family that she would be the wife. You know, it wasn't her decision, it wasn't Charles, it was all of them together. They decided that.
Was she buried up in Canada, or did she return to Logan?
After Charles comes down, and a few years later she comes down, she lives the rest of her life in Salt Lake City. And they go back and forth. And it's interesting, as much of the young married life of Zina Young Card Brown and Hugh B. Brown is in Canada, which is sort of interesting. It's not necessarily because Zina Young Card wants to be Canadian, but Hugh B. Brown's family is from Canada, and so some of their life is up there and then some of it is here. They move around a lot.
Marty, maybe you could describe
Zina Diantha papers are now at the LDS Church Archives. The Zina Card papers are at BYU. And I have a Xerox copy of everything. So those are in my basement. And then we have a whole file cabinet full of letters from like Zina to Hugh and photographs and other assorted things that haven't been... I'm going to give them to the University of Utah so that anybody can look at them. Mary gave the originals of the Zina Diantha stuff and the Zina Presendia stuff to BYU and the LDS Church Archives, but made a Xerox copy of everything. So we have a complete copy of everything. And then we have the originals, the primary sources of this stuff between you and Zina Young Card. We still have that. So.
You sort of depict these women as being cheerful in all this travesty.
Was there much expression of angst or anger or bitterness or...
This is a great question. You know, I've been doing a lot of book groups lately, and that's what women in book groups all want to know. It's really interesting. I never saw any of it. I didn't see that in their letters. I really didn't. And I've read plenty of letters and journals of pioneer women and 19th century women who hated polygamy and hated their husbands and hated the Lord and every, you know, and there's a lot of that. It's not that that was that type of writing. The genre of writing was open to that, but particular women don't write from that position.
Why?
It's possible that they did that wrestling outside of the, you know, I mean, that's one way of explaining it. I mean, it's not just that they were Pollyannas. They weren't. They were earthy women. You know, they dealt with tragedy. I think they each had very difficult things that they dealt with. You know, they didn't have easy lives, any of them. But they don't put it in their letters to each other or in their journals. I do. Yeah. Makes you a lot more self-conscious about what you write in your own journal, doesn't it, when you read the journals of other people?
Do you think there were other journals that may not have come forward?
No. I think there's possible there are more journals. And there are other journals. There are several other Zina Diantha journals, but they're partially destroyed. And this is the most frustrating thing. There's one, for example, that's between 1850 and 51 that it's a little journal. And like half of it's water damaged, and so you can read like three words of a sentence, and then you don't know what she says next, and so it's limited in usefulness. But
some technical scientific way to reveal that.
I don't know. It'd be great, wouldn't it? Yeah. Yeah.
Did you explore any of that
possibility? No. You know, in my family, there's a tradition of having visions, and I think that's probably a better alternative. Yes, Michael.
One of Brigham Young's other wives, Emily Partridge, in her diary, writes about her being financially neglected by Brigham. You mentioned that Zina did not report personal things of that type, but is there evidence that she was in financial difficulty during the time he was alive?
Zina Diantha was always on her own. I mean, even when she was married to Henry, when Henry was gone, she had to provide for herself. And what she almost always did was rely on her brothers. And it's really interesting in that Nauvoo journal, her brothers set up her house. Henry goes on a mission. Her dad comes into her table, you know, when Henry's on a mission. Oliver helps her gather the food in the garden or something like that, but it's always the brothers doing the work. When she gets to Utah, it's Dimmock and Oliver who find her the room in the fort. When she moves to before she moves to the log row, she lives in a wagon for a while, Dimmock's wagon. You know, she's always being supported by her brothers and her family. And she never says, as Emily does, and Emily is her stepsister, right? Because when Zina Baker dies, then he marries Zia, okay? But she never says that. But it's the reality of her life. She always has to support herself. And she does it as a midwife. She does it when she's teaching nursing. She teaches nursing through a school of health in the 70s and 80s. And so she has her own personal... It's not that she's wealthy, but she gets by. And but you know, I could say he neglected her. He neglected many of them, but he also expected them to be independent and resourceful. And I think that's the way she looks at it. I mean, like I thought about that when Zina Prescendia's husband Thomas Williams dies. Brigham's got a huge estate. You know, he has so much wealth. Why didn't Zina just move back into the Lion House or something like that? Doesn't it just seem like the logical thing? And we have this sort of simplistic vision of that family, and it just wasn't. He made them be independent. She was married, she had children, so she had to find a way to support herself. And when she first was widowed, she you know, she didn't really understand what it took to support yourself. So she started producing wax flowers and started selling them at this little art shop in town. And Brigham, when he found out about that, just raised the roof because he just thought that was not an appropriate way to make money for one of his daughters. And so that's when he figured out this other scheme of homesteading and doing that. So, you know. But there are traces of that throughout the stories of each of the women. Zina Prescindia up in Canada has to do that. In fact, the inheritance that Zina Prescindia gets from Brigham's death is the base of the money that funded the settlement of Cardston. Charles is borrowing money from Zina all the time, and it's from that inheritance.
Have you thought through a comparison of the experience of Zina with Annie Clark?
Okay, thanks for reminding me. The question was, have I thought about comparing the experience of Annie Clark Tanner with which of the Zinas?
I guess the contemporary
one. The one would maybe be Zina Prescindia. They were married both during the underground. Right, that's Zina Prescindia. That's on the underground, right. She has a better relationship with Charles. Charles is a more fun man, for one thing. You know, when they're up in Canada, they have a really, they have a lot. It's a really great community. There are a lot of people that they become good friends with. So she has a richer life than Annie Clark Tanner. I think Annie became very bitter because her life had to be so subterranean. She didn't have opportunities to flower in the same way that Zina Prescindia did. So that would be the principal difference, I think. Another thing about Zina Prescindia that was pretty interesting is she was really well connected. She was, you know, when she was in Salt Lake and she was living in the Lion House, she was obviously one of the elite. But those elite networks continue. And, for example, this was one that I really picked up on was when, after Hugh had told her that he wanted to marry Zina, you know, that must have always been in the back of her mind. So she started introducing him around. You know, she set up a meeting with Heber J. Grant for Hugh. And that became a very important relationship for him. And so, you know, they're still part of this network that goes all the way up to Canada. And so Zina Prescindia was still, you know, in a pretty prominent position. She wasn't, you know, they're in different positions in the community.
One of Annie Clark Tanner's sons was one of my uncles. And the boys in that family, when the father died, would not go to his funeral. They had no respect for their father and no love for him at all.
Yeah. Well, you know, anyone who studies polygamy, though, you know, you can't look at it as if it's this homogeneous group. I mean, there were men who were polygamous during this time period who were real schmucks, you know, and he wasn't someone who was decent to his wives, you know. So it's a very different situation. Charles was a good man, and he was beloved in Canada and by each of his wives, and you know, so he fostered good relationships between the wives, and then made sure he had relationships with all the children as well. So, any other questions? Are you exhausted? Yeah?
I was thinking about the Canada situation too earlier. I'm wondering, in your general study with, you know, the business book and all that you've read about polygamy and your situation, was any Canada situation
more typical?
Like that, in your opinion, or for the most part, do you feel it's polygamous type of system?
Her question is, was Annie Clark Tanner's situation probably typical?
No, probably not.
Yeah. Well, see, I think it kind of connects back to Michael's observation that our notion of what a husband ought to do to support a wife includes financial support, emotional support, you know, that kind of thing. And in many polygamous situations, the husband wasn't supporting the plural families. They were required to essentially fend for themselves. And the emotional support, you know, that's even even more difficult to work out. I don't think you can generalize, but my guess would be that there were a whole bunch of families that weren't receiving financial support. Michael?
The only statistical study on the dynamics and success of that period of plural marriage is Kimball Young, who was a great-grandson of Mr. Brigham Young, who didn't like polygamy himself at all, but he did, and one of his graduate students did a lot of interviews with children and wives of polygamous families, and the conclusion was it ended up in thirds. The thirds of the plural marriages were very, very successful, and the wives got along and regarded one another with deep love. About a third of them were just okay, kind of a neutral kind of relationship. A third of them often ending up in divorce.
Well, and if you think about it, those statistics are more healthy than the monogamous population today. So.
The church, you know, consistently used the reasoning to the public that the reason for polygamy was the economics to take care of these women. And it seems that in the readings that I've done and what you're saying, that often did not happen. It was certainly not the reason. They didn't take care of them. But the church taught that it was economic, that all these poor women...
You know what? They stopped teaching that in the 1950s. It's been a long time since they've been delivering that party line. Yeah.
Never more
than 2 or 3% of. Yeah. You know, if you look at the census of Utah in the 50s and 60s, the population was almost evenly balanced between men and women. So many of the sort of stereotypical explanations for polygamy are just not grounded in fact. Another study that I'd recommend you look at if you're interested in that question is Jessie Embry's book, Mormon Polygamous Families, and she interviewed more than 800 children of polygamous families. And they talk about, there are different chapters that talk about when it worked, when it didn't work, when they were supported, when they, and that would be maybe something else that you could look at as well. It's really good. Anyway, sure.
Another question on the documents, on that many Trump people discovered.
I know.
If you look at all the evidence for these four designers and the various families, is there any blank space there where you say, here's where we're missing something?
Yeah, Missouri was a blank space for me. It was hard to reconstruct the Missouri time period, even though it was really short. So much was going on there. And what you have is Oliver's autobiography, which he describes it as a journal, but it's written, you know, a little later. And then Dimmick writes a real spotty account of that time period, and that was a black hole to me. And I wish that Zina Prescendia had kept a journal in Cardston. What you have are primarily letters from Charles to Zina, not so many letters back. I mean, there are hundreds of letters from Charles to Zina, but you know, only a handful going back. So you're getting one point of view and kind of reading the story from that perspective. And then I also wish that the last Zina had written a journal instead of just letters. I think you write differently in those two places. And even Mary thinks that Zina, the last Zina, feels the most flat. And I wish we knew more about what was going on in her head about the choices that she made. You know, I would have liked to have had that.
Be able to talk to their children.
Yeah, oral interviews with all the children that were still living, and those were fun. By that time I was sort of blown away by these women, and so it just was so amazing to sit at a table with like Zola Hodson, their oldest daughter, and think that the way she set the table for, you know, the lunch that she gave me was probably the way her mother first set the table. And, you know, it just was so amazing to think about how many of our gestures and the way we speak or the kind of images we refer to or the things we believe in, how much of that we inherit from the people who came before us. And So I just, you know, I was really interested in the lines. One of the things I end the book with is my father was in, my father died 2 years ago, and he was in the hospital for a month before he died. He was unconscious, and you know, it was a really hard time. Mary came up to the hospital, and she asked me how I was, and I said, oh, well, I have a stomach ache. You know, I was feeling pretty crappy. And she said, oh, you need to go home and make my mother's recipe for ginger tea. And I just bawled because it was just, you know, the convergence of all these great planets. It was so cool because, you know, that was just this comfort that had come down through the generations of these women and was given to me so freely and naturally and really meant a lot to me. I really loved that moment. And anyway, so any other questions? Thank you so much for inviting me to be here.